This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Later this hour, we'll hear a series of stories looking into where Florida's Democratic and gubernatorial candidates stand on issues ranging from school safety to infrastructure to the current algae crisis. But first, Florida's August 28th primary election is now less than a week away, and early voting is underway at select locations in all of Florida's 67 counties. In addition to the Republican and Democratic primary contests and the race for governor, there are a number of other key statewide primaries and congressional elections taking place. Meanwhile, Florida's ongoing toxic algae bloom crisis is a frequent talking point of candidates on the campaign trail. How is that crisis, along with other hot-button issues this year, shaping the election? Plus, we now know that Russian hackers targeted at least 21 states, including Florida, in the 2016 election. State officials have never acknowledged how many counties were targeted by Russian hackers that year, and concerns about election security persist. How is that impacting voter behavior and voter confidence? Joining me now to explore these questions and much more is Florida Gulf Coast University political science professor Dr. Roger Green. Welcome back to the program, Roger. Always great to speak with you.
Hi, John. Nice to be here.
And we're joined by fellow political science professor Dr. Aubrey Jewett from the University of Central Florida. Thanks for taking the time.
Yes, thanks for having me on today.
And we're also speaking with longtime Florida political and legislative reporter Steve Bosquet. Steve is the Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief, which he joined in 2001, following 17 years with the Miami Herald, where he also served as Tallahassee Bureau Chief. Steve Bosquet, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
And as always, we invite listeners to join the conversation. If you're voting next Tuesday, or if you've already cast your ballot, what issues are driving you to the polls this year? Give us a call now and share your thoughts on Florida's primary election races. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU, using the hashtag GCL. And now, I don't necessarily want to spend too much time on this, as it's likely to be the topic of just about any other news program you're going to hear today. But as I'm sure we're all aware, former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort was convicted yesterday on federal tax and bank fraud charges. Also yesterday, Trump's former longtime personal attorney Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to multiple crimes, including 5 counts of tax evasion, 1 count of falsifying submissions to a bank, and 2 counts involving unlawful campaign contributions. And starting with you, Dr. Green, could yesterday's historic events have much of an impact on, you know, what we're going to see in next Tuesday's primary race? And by that, I mean we have this GOP gubernatorial frontrunner, Ron DeSantis, with Trump's endorsement. And that's kind of been a cornerstone of his campaigning. Do you think yesterday's revelations on Manafort and Cohen could have much of an impact on how voters would see DeSantis going forward versus his opponent in that primary, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam?
I think the likely impact would be greater in a general election if DeSantis actually manages to win the primary. You know, the voters who tend to turn out for primaries oftentimes are the more committed, energized kind of ideologically strong part of the base. And I think for many of those who've gravitated toward DeSantis because of his early and consistent linkage to Trump, I'm not sure that any revelations about Trump would necessarily sway them in the direction of Putnam. But that is certainly something that could have an enormous impact in a general election if DeSantis is the one who gets the primary nod from Republicans.
And Aubrey Jewett with the University of Central Florida, anything to add to that, either as yesterday's revelations relate to the gubernatorial Republican primary or, you know, Florida's primary races next Tuesday more broadly?
Well, I pretty much agree with what Roger said. I think that the Trump supporters pretty much will just double down, and they'll support Trump even harder. They'll feel like he's under attack, and so I don't think it'll have much influence on the primary race. But as Roger said, potentially over the next 2 months, depending on what happens. For instance, if allegations are made that Trump has actually violated campaign finance laws, and perhaps he's charged himself, you know, that could have a big impact on the general election. But, of course, we don't know what, if anything, is going to happen between now and then.
Right. And, you know, similar to Adam Putnam, who once called Trump, you know, quote, abhorrent and dishonorable, Southwest Florida's own GOP Agriculture Commission candidate Matt Caldwell is also dealing with this issue of having once been a never Trumper. And he's since changed his tune. Do you think yesterday's revelations are going to have, you know, candidates like this reevaluating their strategies regarding how they purport themselves to view the president? I guess that would be assuming they win their primaries.
Right. Well, I guess my opinion, this is Aubrey Jewett, my thought is that most Republican candidates will be assessing and reassessing how they present themselves with Donald Trump over the next 2 months. I mean, I think they would have been doing this anyway because they have to consider, you know, how their relationship with Donald Trump is going to impact winning or losing. And, you know, there's a couple candidates like Ron DeSantis, for instance, who's so wrapped up with Trump that he probably couldn't, you know, disentangle himself. On the other hand, somebody like Rick Scott, you know, he's already sort of been keeping Trump at an arm's length for the past few months. And so, you know, he already made that conscious decision that he's not going to say anything bad necessarily about Trump. On the other hand, he's not going to embrace him and perhaps not going to campaign with him either.
And Steve Bosquet, I think probably among us on this show today, you're probably the most acutely aware of how quickly things can change in the news cycle. Do you think this is something, you know, November's pretty far away. I mean, can we really even predict what candidates are going to do in regards to their relationship with the president? Or are we just going to have to be all sort of watching that play out together?
Well, you know, having Trump in your corner is such a big asset in a primary, but it becomes a totally different ballgame in the general election. Mm-hmm. Trump, assuming Ron DeSantis is the nominee of the Republican Party, voters should get ready for an election that is largely a referendum on Trump. Mm-hmm. I agree with Roger Green. I don't think this is going to have much of an effect on the results next Tuesday for a couple of reasons that we haven't talked about yet on this program, one of which is and people in politics need to re-engineer their thinking. The majority of people who are going to vote in this primary have already voted.
Yeah,
we've got about 1.3 million ballots in the can, and based on past history, not many more than about 2 million are going to vote. So it's really sort of too late for a strategic change that I think would fundamentally affect and change the way people make their vote choice. And I also would remind folks that in every poll we've seen, Donald Trump's popularity with the Republican base is as strong or stronger in Florida than most any place in the country. So there's a real loyalty factor there that I can't picture Mrs. Jones sitting at her kitchen table with her absentee ballot, watching CNN or yeah. Fox and yeah. saying, now that Michael Cohen has pleaded guilty, or has been indicted, rather, I need to change the way I vote. I don't think people think that way.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, since you brought up this issue of voter participation in the primary, and I think you just posted a story about this just this very morning, how are those numbers breaking down along party lines?
The Republicans have an advantage. Again, I don't think it's really statistically significant in a primary because you've got what you have, of course, are two totally separate elections going on in two different silos.
Right.
For example, I find out, you know, the Democratic Party has a practice of not running a party get-out-the-vote effort in a primary, and they leave the GOTV efforts to the individual candidates. So we're seeing some anomalies. They're not huge, but the Republicans have about a 5 percentage point advantage in turnout, 47% to 42% for the Democrats. The no-party affiliation voters, who are almost 30% of the electorate, are not voting in numbers anywhere near that proportion for an obvious reason. We're a closed primary state that shuts out independent voters in party primaries, for the most part. They can vote in judicial races and some nonpartisan races locally.
Right.
So, but the turnout is a little bit higher than it was 4 years ago at this time, and the turnout is especially strong in Tampa Bay. I would make those observations.
Yeah. I noticed Hillsborough and Pinellas had about like 15% of the vote each. Is that right?
The 15% combined.
Oh, combined. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is partly a reflection of a really aggressive vote-by-mail strategy by the Pinellas Elections Office.
And Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's all. That's it.
And Roger, I know from our previous conversation, something that you've emphasized is that Democrats just tend to not come out in the same numbers that Republicans do during non-presidential election years. But do we have any sort of data that would indicate trends in how Democrats versus Republicans vote? And by that, I mean, are Democrats more likely to actually come out on election day versus taking advantage of mail-in ballots or early voting?
Yeah, but that, the difficulty strategically that Democrats have historically faced in non-presidential midterm election years is that certain of the sort of key constituencies or segments of the Democratic electorate, primarily young people and minority voters, they're the ones whose voter participation or turnout levels tend to drop off in non-presidential election years. Now there is some evidence based on what's been happening in the primaries in other states that would suggest potentially higher turnout when we get around to the general election this fall, particularly on the Democratic side. We've had about 30 states so far that have had congressional primaries and 20 or so that have had gubernatorial primaries. And, the analysis is showing that the turnout levels have been much higher at this point than they were in 2010 or 2014. So there could be some reason to expect a more mobilized Democratic electorate turning out for the general election. But there's also a lot of evidence from these other states that Republican turnout or participation has been increasing as well. So it's still going to be difficult to make predictions about what's going to happen in the general election.
Okay. Well, let's put a little bit more of an eye on the gubernatorial primary races here. As we discussed, on the Republican side, we've got two front runners. They held just two debates. The Democratic field is rather crowded. You've got five front runners. They held, I think, five debates total. Is it unusual to see that many, Democrats in the primary for the governor's race here in Florida? Do you think that the number of candidates we're seeing could perhaps be reflective of the results of the 2016 election? Aubrey
Jewett? It is unusual to have so many candidates that are being considered viable, meaning that they actually show up in the polls with at least 5 or 10% support. And really, I think you could make the case that it's still possible for four of these five candidates to win. Chris King here from Orlando has always been pretty low in the polls compared to the other four. Gillum has been running third, fourth, but he, Mayor Tallahassee, but he seems to be on a little bit of a surge. And at the top, it seems to be Glenn Graham and Philip Levine still duking it out. And I think, the fact that it was an open seat race, the fact that the Democrats expect that there will be some sort of a blue wave, that there'll be a lot of Democrats turning out, as Roger said, who want to basically cast a vote against Donald Trump, even though he's not on the ballot. Mm. So that has a lot of Democrats thinking, hey, this is finally, after 20 years, we could maybe finally break through and win the governorship here in Florida.
And Steve Bosquet, as a reporter, I wanted to ask you this question because I've gotten a lot of email inquiries and social media inquiries from people who have aligned themselves with candidates who are not necessarily considered front runners. And a lot of these messages are, they kind of blame members of the media like you and me for not paying attention to these candidates. And sometimes I'm thinking like, well, if your guy's polling at less than 1%, I don't know what there is to talk about. But do you think they have a point? Does the media have a role in sort of deciding who becomes a front runner and who doesn't simply because of what we choose to cover?
Well, I think covering five candidates is a handful.
Sure.
It is true. Florida used to have crowded primaries like this in the 70s and to some degree in the 80s. And I recall one time when Jeb Bush ran, Jeb had two or three credible opponents in the Republican primary, but he basically won the race outright for the nomination. So, with the resources we have at the Times and the Miami Herald, we've chosen to try to cover these five as best we can. the polling and other you know, evidence seems to indicate that, that it's a race between Gwen Graham and Philip Levine, but the entry into this race of Jeff Green has been a bit of a game changer. There's a really good story out there today by our colleague David Smiley of the Miami Herald, who talks about Green being a disruptor in this race. Polls indicate Green is not going to be the nominee, but he spent you know, tens of millions of dollars, a lot of it on advertising, including advertising criticizing his opponents. So we're going to see. And the fact that Green and Levine are both from South Florida and both have a similar profile and are self-funding candidates suggests that they're sort of drawing from the same base, if not geographic, than a demographic base in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I would follow that just by agreeing and saying that Jeff Green's entrance into the race, I think, had an enormous impact on what might otherwise have been an even more powerful boost that Phil Levine enjoyed when he entered the race. This could have been quite different if it had just been Phil Levine as, you know, one of those independently wealthy candidates from South Florida competing against Gwen Graham rather than Phil Levine and Jeff Green against Gwen Graham.
Okay. And, you know, I personally covered the Democratic gubernatorial primary debate that was held here at Florida Gulf Coast University. And, you know, I have to say, maybe I'm just a little Pollyanna about this, but I was kind of disappointed. It felt more like a party pep rally than it did an event intended to actually vet candidates. But by and large, they tend to agree on where they stand on the issues. Is that typical for a primary debate, Roger?
Well, no. Usually you would see some effort made by at least one or two of the candidates to more aggressively and strategically position themselves, even if it's in the form of finding one or two issues on which they can attack, you know, at least the person they perceive as a front runner. So it's almost like in some cases people, I think, in the debates were – you know, certainly in the FGCU one, they were trying so hard to not make a mistake or error that they didn't really do much to differentiate themselves from one another.
Yeah, it seemed like there was much less reluctance to go after one another versus, you know, what I've heard in the two Republican primaries, DeSantis and Putnam held.
Yeah.
Well, with Florida's primary election less than a week away, we're taking a closer look at key issues and races dominating the election with Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief Steve Mosquet, University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett, and FGCU political science professor Roger Green. If you'd like to join our conversation, listeners are always welcome to join the show. If you're voting in this primary, what issues are motivating your decisions and why? Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. And, of course, a major hot-button issue for this debate, or I mean for this election right now, is the ongoing toxic algae bloom crisis. Just yesterday, the city of Fort Myers declared a state of emergency. Governor Rick Scott has declared separate states of emergency in recent weeks for counties impacted by both the blue-green algae and then also the red tide. How have we seen this playing out on the campaign trail? And I'll go to Aubrey Jewett first.
Well, I think in the Senate race in particular, it's become a little bit of a political hot potato with Governor Scott basically saying, oh, the federal government, and then by extension, Senator Bill Nelson, you know, they haven't done enough in Lake Okeechobee and with the dam there and the water levels and this sort of thing, and that the state's done a lot and that the federal government has not. But then, of course, Bill Nelson firing back and saying, well, no, you know, you look at the really bad environmental record of Rick Scott, and, you know, this is really largely a state issue and a state problem. And so it really does seem to have, at least so far, been more of an issue at the Senate level. Of course, maybe it's because, you know, we're only in a primary situation for the governor's race, and once we hit the general, it'll rise in importance there as well.
Yeah. Interesting point. Yeah, I mean, since Scott moved into the governor's mansion in 2011, his policy decisions haven't really earned him many allies in the environmental advocacy community. Could this current toxic algae bloom crisis have come at a worse time for him?
Well, maybe if it extends for another 2 months,
it'll
be even a little worse. But it definitely is not. Yeah, it's not a good thing for him for sure. And if a lot of voters are looking at the environment as one of their top, two or three issues, then that's probably not great news for the governor. Quite frankly, again, because he doesn't have a very good record. Just objectively, especially if you compare him to, say, the two previous Republican governors, Charlie Crist and Jeb Bush, who actually had pretty respectable environmental records. And even a lot of environmentalists said, okay, well, we would like more, but they're doing, they are doing some things that we'd like. Whereas with Governor Scott, when he came in, and because we were at the height or the depth, as it were, of the Great Recession, he made no bones about it that economy and jobs are his number one thing. So he, got rid of the Department of Community Affairs. He basically stacked the water management districts and other boards and commissions with developers and builders and hardly any environmentalists. They've been much less, far fewer prosecutions in terms of going after polluters. So that's just a policy choice that he affirmatively made.
Yeah, one of the things about the major water-related issues like this one is that the responsibility for implementing and monitoring the policies like those, it's kind of fractured across multiple levels of government, and that makes it easier for candidates to try distancing themselves from responsibility. Mm-hmm. It's kind of spread across the federal and state levels, but I mean, certainly if one wants to find some ammunition to use against Scott in the Senate election, 8 years in the governor's office and, a pretty consistent anti-environmental record is something that would be pretty strong ammunition.
Yeah, I mean, whether we're talking about the gubernatorial primaries or the Senate contest in November between Nelson and Scott, is this issue about the algae crisis something that maybe instead of being used to your advantage is something politicians might be wary of discussing just because it is such a complicated issue? And, some people say septic systems are part of the problem. Some people say it's not. And like you said, the Army Corps of Engineers which controls the water releases from Lake Okeechobee is a federal agency, but then there's other state agencies involved. And it's just a complicated issue.
Yeah, and that because of that, it kind of facilitates the effort by candidates who've been in office to distance themselves and to shirk responsibility and point the finger at others. So I'm not sure if that will play out in a tremendously strong way in either direction. But I think that it would probably be strategically easier for Nelson to paint Scott as somebody who bears a large measure of responsibility if in fact they kind of, craft a kind of compelling message in that direction. But I haven't seen that quite as effectively done so far as I would have anticipated, I guess.
John, this is Steve Bosquet. I think this is going to be an important issue in the general election. I think that it remains to be seen how it's going to play out. I agree with the comments that it's a sort of an octopus, in terms of trying to pin accountability because there are so many overlapping state and federal agencies. But I think people viscerally can look at the political landscape and say that Rick Scott has a lot more influence over state environmental decisions than Bill Nelson has over federal environmental decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think people get that, number one. And number two, this is a highly emotional issue that is something else, very sadly, about our state, but true. It's a very compelling visual political story. It's pretty easy to illustrate this problem in a 30-second ad. And, Rick Scott, as you've seen in the recent past several news cycles, Rick Scott wants to keep the focus on this alleged Russian hacking issue.
Yes.
As much as he can. I think talking about the environment it cuts both ways for both these candidates. But my intuition and instincts tell me this is more perilous for Rick Scott, this issue.
On the Russian hacking thing, since you just brought that up, and I'm glad you did because that's where I was going to take the conversation anyway. So Nelson's alleging that Russian hackers have penetrated election systems in some Florida counties and, quote, have free rein to move about End quote. And as you just noted, Scott has kind of jumped on Nelson about that, calling on him to provide proof, which he hasn't at this point. And then just on Monday, the director of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security secretary issued a joint letter saying that their agencies see no signs of new or ongoing compromises of state and local election systems. Steve, catch us up on this story.
Sure. Okay. Well, the most recent development is a couple of hours ago, Rick Scott went on Fox News and bludgeoned Bill Nelson again, saying he was reckless and was sowing confusion and doubt in the minds of voters and so forth. And it is true that a number of the election supervisors at the county level are upset with Nelson. They don't like the way he handled this, and this was not Nelson's finest hour. You know, Nelson's been on the political scene in the state for 40 years, and I've always known Nelson, above all, to be a person who chooses his words with great care and speaks with precision. I was the reporter who first asked him about this issue the very first time on August 7th, and the question that's, I posted the transcript on our Buzz blog this morning. The question was really whether he agreed or disagreed with Marco Rubio that the counties were well prepared enough, and he agreed with Rubio the counties are not well prepared enough. Then he went into this riff about how the Russians are in our records, and he wouldn't elaborate and said it was classified. So I would say Nelson has not handled this issue very well at all. He's handled it very clumsily. Mm-hmm. And there have been these statements by senators on the Intelligence Committee that neither corroborated nor contradicted what Nelson has said. And we've heard rumors to the effect that there was evidence that two counties' voting systems were attacked or targeted in some way. I don't know which two counties, and we haven't been able to verify that.
Right.
But I think it's noteworthy, John, I want to let your other guests have a word on this. It's noteworthy that this afternoon there's a closed-door session of the United States Senate where every senator is getting a briefing from FBI and Homeland Security on the nature of the Russian threat in this election cycle. This is about election preparedness. So, I mean, while Nelson may or may not have had his facts straight, it appears that this issue is of grave concern to everybody on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Aubrey Jewett, anything to add to that?
Not too much. I think that was pretty thorough, but I would agree that this is an issue that it's not going to go away on two fronts until such time as Bill Nelson or someone else can provide a bit more evidence that what he said was factually correct, that Russian hackers actually did get into, I mean, that's the way it comes across to the average person when they see the story, and that Russian hackers have already succeeded at some point, you know, in hacking into local Florida election systems. And I have never seen any evidence of that directly. And as we just said, you know, the two folks at the federal level came out and said, you know, that it hasn't happened. Anyway, so I do think that that's going to continue to be an issue that Governor Scott, you know, hammers away, and then just more broadly, that the issue of Russian hacking is going to be, continuing till the general election, and that could have a little bit of negative impact on Republicans and Trump, depending on what happens, you know, with some of these Mueller investigation and some of the other court cases that are going on separately. So yeah. We'll have to see what happens.
Well, and aside specifically from, just how this is impacting the Senate race, we've also seen this recently widely carried story about an 11-year-old hacking a replica of Florida's voting system in 10 minutes. That plus this conversation about potential Russian interference or meddling. Is this potentially raising serious concerns about election integrity or security that might motivate some folks just to not participate at all?
I don't know if it's going to – I don't anticipate that it would dampen voter turnout. And we do have continuing problems in terms of election systems integrity and administration in the United States, and that's partly because the Constitution delegates authority to oversee federal elections to the states, but in many cases – the funding levels that are required to kind of upgrade them and protect them simply isn't there. But I think this was sort of an inept strategy on the part of Nelson to even raise this. I think he has much more potent issues available. As Steve was pointing out, the toxic algae issue provides visually compelling material that could be used against Scott. And in addition, simply making consistent efforts to link Scott to Donald Trump, which, of course, Scott is doing everything he can to kind of hold Trump at arm's length, that would be much more strategic than trying to get weighed into the bog of Russian meddling in the election.
Mm-hmm. And we have a few minutes left here, but I just wanted to touch on this really unusual election-related story that actually gained some national attention about a Florida Republican state House primary candidate, Melissa Howard, dropping out of the race for House District 73 in Sarasota and Manatee counties after admitted she lied about her college credentials and going so far as to circulate a photo of a fraudulent diploma. And then initially, after admitting to the deception, saying that she was still going to stay in the race. And in covering this story, I could not get Sarasota or Manatee County Republican Party officials on the phone to comment. And I know some reporters who did, and they were not calling on her to drop out of this race. Is that unusual, or would they usually step back, even in this unusual circumstance, and say, we're not going to pick the primary candidate?
I don't think it's unusual to try to stand back from that. And it's there are probably more people out there, not only politicians, but others who are claiming college degrees who don't have them than people realize. Mm. I think sometimes people can kind of convince themselves through kind of incrementally embellishing their credentials over a period of years or decades and not getting caught. And so they cease to even regard this as a deception. I think they somehow regard it as fact. So I didn't necessarily find the developments in that regard surprising, even though they were quite interesting.
Yeah. And Steve Bosquet, and your longstanding coverage of political issues here in Florida, have you ever seen anything quite this, well, brazen?
No. I mean, this comes up every couple of cycles where somebody is caught lying about their history, embellishing about their past, trying to obscure a run-in with the law, stuff like that. What's noteworthy in this case is the extent of how elaborate this artifice was, including the photograph with the mother and so forth. But in this case, of course, the story was broken by a young blogger who just started a website. But I would say the system works. The system works. It gets unearthed. It gets reported on. And at first, I think Melissa Howard said she was going to sort of tough it out and stay on the ballot and stay in this race. But within about 24 hours, she was out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's also worth noting that just dropping out of the race doesn't really mean this is over for her. I mean, based on how you interpret Florida statute, she may have committed a first-degree misdemeanor here. So I guess that story will still be developing regardless of the primary. Well, we are about all out of time for this portion of the show, but I want to thank my guests. We've been speaking with Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief Steve Bosquet. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks, John.
Also, thanks to University of Central Florida political science professor Dr. Aubrey Jewett. Great to connect with you again.
Yes, thank you.
And as always, Dr. Roger Green, chair of the Department of Political Science and Public Administration here at Florida Gulf Coast University. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, John.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, I recently teamed up with the Florida Public Radio reporters across the state for a series of stories exploring where the state's Democratic and Republican gubernatorial candidates stand on issues from school safety to infrastructure to the current algae crisis. We'll hear those stories just ahead. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.